Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. I'm your host, Benji. My guest on the show today is Greg Crabtree, author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits. Greg's approach to financial controls and profitability, honed through decades of accounting and consulting work, is refreshingly simple and easy to understand. I read the book in about a week, and what I loved about it is he distills the all too often confusing world of accounting into like incredibly simple metrics and core areas for you to focus on as a business owner. In today's conversation, you can expect to learn a bunch of stuff, but here are the highlights. Why your gross margin is your true top line and revenue is one of the flakiest, most meaningless metrics to care about. Why your income taxes paid is actually a KPI you want to optimize for and not against. We talk about the only two ways to boost labor productivity and get out of the profitability black hole between 1 and 5 million. And lastly, how to install an NFL-style salary cap system and ensure you don't get a bloated overhead. Greg is a G. I love this conversation. If you like his style, check out the article from him that we linked in the description called The Best Team Money Can Buy. That's it for me. Let's dive in with Greg Crabtree. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Greg, welcome to Contractor Evolution. It's really good to have you, my friend.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me.
You say in Simple Numbers, the book, that accountants make finances too hard to understand. And I think that that is an experience, a feeling, an awkward moment that probably a lot of us as entrepreneurs have had. So why do you think accountants do that? And what should we do about it?
A lot of it is accountants don't understand who their customer is. You know, and so at the end of the day, they end up, you know, they think their customer is the third party that's using the information. You know, is it the taxing agency? Is it the bank? Is it an investor? And we missed probably what I think should have been our truest calling. How do you help a business run in an exceptional level on a consistent basis? And how does that data work? Now, part of it came from a time frame when we didn't have ERP systems. We didn't have, you know, good low-cost systems like QuickBooks, Xero, and the like that, you know, could easily produce information. You had a very slow process of assembling information, and it was very clunky to actually get, you know, the margin creation part of finance connected together to give fast reporting. But it still doesn't mean that, I mean, we have clients that were able to get that data even with very rudimentary systems. But a lot of it is just a philosophy. And so, you know, when I, you know, kind of the change of thinking for me became when I joined the Entrepreneurs Organization in 2001, and I changed my focus to stop thinking of myself as an accountant. I thought of myself as an entrepreneur. I just happened to have skills in accounting. And as I made my peer group entrepreneurs, not other accountants, it dramatically changed my thinking of, hey, this is really what the market needs and how can I go solve it? Now, it required me to do something that is not in the mindset of the average accountant. I actually had to go study data with nobody else paying me to do it. But I happen to have access to extremely valuable information from our clients to study it and say, what is, you know, don't go to it with a proof context that you're trying to get, you know, create a proof case for. Go to it and ask the data a simple question. What are you trying to tell me? What insights can I get from this? And once you start to get reps of seeing information, it's amazing the simplicity of what elevates to the surface of there's only four or five numbers that really matter relative to finance. And in every business out there. And as we continue to validate that with, you know, every month touching hundreds of businesses' data, you know, I mean, I used to think when I came up with my original ideas, you know, it's like I shot my wad and I, you know, what else am I going to tell people? But it's like, you know, we learn something new every day. And really, we're at a very interesting time in the marketplace where we're coming to the end of what I call the participation trophy economy. You know, the last 25 years has been a gift of the market, is how most people grew, rather than actually going out and winning market share. And a lot of this is based on population demographics. And as we now hit the stage in North America, and really most of the world, except for a handful of countries, the vast majority of population has now peaked and is actually slightly declining. And so how do you grow a business? We're predisposed as business. You got to grow. Really? Do I have to grow? May not. Growth may not be the best answer. You know, and really, you know, first and foremost, we're huge fans of creating profitability and stability in a business, and then figuring out, looking more for opportunistic growth rather than the traditional month over month scaling. Growth is going to become very, very uneven in the coming years just because of the marketplace itself. And I've got to think differently, because now I'm in what we refer to as a street fight economy. We've got to go punch our competitor in the mouth and take their business away from them, which is a completely different customer acquisition model and strategy than, hey, I just want to be known, seen, the next new customer that comes along, we're going to get a disproportionate share of that growth. Well, when that's not there, how do you grow? And there are definitely growth strategies, but, you know, I'm neither for or against growth. I am for running a stable business. You grow when growth is available. You can't manufacture growth in a flat to slightly declining economy.
Oh, there's so much here I want to dig into. So there's
nice to throw you a little bomb. To start
a few
off with,
bombs here. I did actually want to ask you about the EO stuff and what you did with Vern Harnish, but let's come back to that in a second, because what seems more poignant right now is, and I love the way you termed it, the end of the participation trophy economy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, to me, it seems, and I would say to us at Breakthrough Academy, and we have a very interesting vantage point in the sense that we coach and advise, you know, 600 contractors all over North America. We can see their data. We have an audience, you know, that are not necessarily clients, but listeners of this show and people that we interact with at trade shows and just a larger audience. And we're able to see quite a large aggregate perspective. And what you just said to me rings unbelievably true. Now, in our little cohort, in our group, there are some incredibly high performers. But if I look more broadly out there in the market, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, there's a lot of bozos who have done incredibly well over the last 10 or 15 years with not a whole lot of skill, not a whole lot of strategy, not a whole lot of work ethic. They've just sort of been on a rising tide. So that's a pretty hot take, but that's my view on things. Is that what you're talking about when you mention the everyone gets a trophy economy?
It is, because there wasn't a great separation. As much as we would love to tout it in the business consulting community, you would love to think, oh, if I have a great culture, if I have really excellent operations and I do all these things that leads me to be a great business, I'll separate myself from the crowd. Can't say that actually happened in the last 20 years, and especially the last, I would say, when you take from 2011 up until probably 22, that period of time. Now, you had the distortion of COVID, and depending on how your business and location was impacted by COVID. But a lot of our clients actually weren't impacted by COVID at all. You know, if they were in areas that didn't have severe lockdowns and those things, there was still a pretty good amount of profitability and growth, you know, during those periods. But there was just no difference between, like you said, the bozo that just rolled out their business card and, you know, had a truck and a cell phone and they could be successful in business because they were the next man up that was available.
Yeah.
And if they happened to have reasonably decent, you know, just intuitive skills, they could get away with it because the market wasn't very discerning, you know, in that time frame, because there was excess demand to limited capacity. Now that the two are equal to probably right now excess capacity to demand, now we're starting to see the separation between those who are really good and those who are not. And so one of the things that we get to do, because our consulting practice is not geographic to where, you know, my team is. So we have clients all over the U.S. and really all over the world. So one of the things that we did to actually get a read on the economy is we call it our simple numbers 100 company model. So we have 100 clients of all different industries, all different geographies that we use as kind of our economic guide. Is what is the market actually doing? And what we've seen in the last, you know, really 18 months is the marketplace has settled into an average of about a 5.5% growth year over year of revenue. But once I apply my best guess of inflation, now I am just a chicken farmer from Alabama by upbringing, so you can take this for whatever it's worth. But we found this model to be incredibly insightful. My sense is the actual economy is probably negative 2-3% GDP. And now, is that a bad thing? Well, not necessarily. I mean, do you know anybody that's unemployed? I mean, truly unemployed that can't find a job? Now, they may not have the job that they want, but I guarantee you there is an unpleasant, dirty, smelly, hot, you know, difficult job that they could actually make really good money. They just don't want to do that one.
Right.
Oh, I want this one. Right. Well, okay, you're not unemployed then.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I was coming up in the 70s and 80s, I mean, we had periods of time where we had 11, 12% unemployment that was real unemployment. You actually had people on breadlines that were capable, willing people that could not find a job to feed their family. We're not experiencing that. It's exact opposite. And so here's the part that everybody's got to understand. When you run out of labor, you know, I got news for the economic managers of the economy is that when you have a constriction of labor, there is going to be inflation to some degree. And right now there's been a little bit of a pause, more so because you got a lot of people sitting on their hands waiting for the U.S. elections, you know, that'll be here in a couple of weeks. But once those elections are done, there's some pent-up demand that will get us back to probably the true run rate of the economy. And that will push labor, a little increases in labor for lack of constriction. It'll increase demand, but then it's going to stall and settle in to what core demand is. And so there, what you're going to see is a marketplace where if you have 15 competitors, it's going to shrink to 10. But those 10 will be better businesses than we were at 15, because the market will the market just has, unless the government overtly interferes, the market has an amazing capacity to balance itself over time if you give it time and don't interfere with it, and that's what we expect to see is a spurt of activity post election for about 6 to 9, maybe 12 months depending on mobilization of activity, and then it's going to stall and settle into core demand because there is no component to grow the economy. Because when I have a constriction of labor, I'm constricting demand and supply. It takes both.
Yep.
Unless I have excess labor, I can't, you know, it's going to cause inflation, but I also need consumers. And if I don't have a growing consumer base, And so if you look at the population demographics in North America, you know, we went from a pyramid by a demographic to a chimney stack throughout most of the teens from 2010 to 2020. And now we're the inverted pyramid. We have fewer people behind us at the younger ages that we need, that those are the primary consumers of the economy. And as that bottom end shrinks and you see, I mean, U.S. posted 1.6 replacement birth rate last year. 2.1 is stable society.
Canada's 1.37 or 1.4.
We're even lower.
It's even worse. It's not good. It's really not good. People need to get out there and have kids.
But there again, I mean, that last time I checked, it takes 20 years to grow a working human. You know, so,
yeah, so we're kind of already too late.
Change.
Yeah, it's well said. So, look,
So these are things that you got to take into account, but there is a decent amount of core demand. And I want to be one of those 10 out of the 15 that is a better business and survives versus the 5 that get spit out, merged in, and consolidated into the marketplace.
So this is sort of the perfect setup or kind of framing around this conversation we're going to have today, which is a quick run through of your book and some of the fundamental principles in it, which is called Simple Numbers. And there's a section of it that's really devoted to the four keys. And I don't want to get into that, but first, with everything that you just said and what you're seeing and what you're feeling in the marketplace, answer two questions for me. One is, what kind of extra pressure or extra meaning or emphasis needs to go on the understanding, tracking, and data-driven decision-making that a business owner makes based on sound fundamental financials? One. And two, how should people also kind of understand this four keys, this four numbers framework that we're going to get into here over the rest of the conversation?
Well, the answer to the first question is the error that my peers made in structuring financial data is the fact that revenue is the weakest number on the P&L.
Say more.
It's just a starting point for math. And especially because your audience as a contractor is a perfect example. So if they look on page 22 of the original book, Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits, I show an example of a construction company and a services business. And once I filter out cost of goods sold, that does not include your self-performance labor, your direct labor, that's W-2 to you, not a contractor. That gross margin is the true economic top line of the business. That is the respect that the market gives you as a business for what you add to the materials and the subcontractors in your industry. And so, I mean, and you know, I'd known contractors for years that, oh, I'm a $25 million contractor. Yeah, I'm a $35 million. Big whoop-de-doo. I said, you got a pickup truck and a cell phone. Tell me how many people work for you, and that's really what matters. And so at the end of the day, once you do that filtering of the materials and the subs and get down to gross margin, that's the service value that your business delivers to the marketplace. And I just came back from 2 days with a focus. We have a peer group of renovation contractors that I spent two days with going over their data as a peer group. And from all over the country, so they all have very different outcomes just because of the locale that they're in as well. But there's an amazing consistency of only two numbers out of that P&L I got to pay attention to. What's my gross margin and what's my total labor, regardless of what that labor does? Mm. I don't care if you do self-performance work. I don't care if you just have project managers. I don't care if you do the estimates or you hire an estimator. As long as you pay yourself a market-based wage as an owner for the job that you do and everybody else on your team, I've got to get $2 of gross margin for every dollar of labor that I have on payroll. Mm. Everything else works. Everything else works from that. And the only distortion from this group of renovation companies that put pressure on that 2-to-1 ratio was when somebody overspent on marketing because we went through this. Probably from about March until now, the market has been absolutely resistant to marketing input. You can throw all the marketing dollars you want at it. You ain't getting any leads because everybody's sitting on their hand until the election. And in most markets, the only people who successfully grew during that period did it the old fashioned way by human to human networking and found a couple of key jobs because of their personal relationships versus the quality of leads from paid search and any of those type of things has just been absolutely atrocious for most of the summer. Now, I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying to turn it up produced no benefit.
Right.
I mean, it was just pathetic. And the other thing that I threw in there to kind of shock the group is, and here's my prediction. I think Google will make little to nothing, probably close to nothing, from paid search in about 24 months. Because as AI search becomes the dominant way that we search, it's not influenced by paid promotion through the general internet. You know, so if you're relying on Google search words, AdWords, paid promotion, you better be scrambling to find a way for the AI search engines to find you. We're going to go back to organic search and ability for people to find you is going to be the primary way if you're going to use any type of digital media.
Do you think that that extends for other platforms like Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn? Are you saying paid traffic in general is dead, or is it Google in particular?
So Facebook is totally different because it does have paid commercials. It will always have paid commercials that will be inserted into your feed.
Correct.
And so from Facebook standpoint, that won't be the case. But when it comes to generic search to find you, you know, on the internet, that will absolutely be the case.
Super interesting.
Here's the thing. We've seen a significant rise in the last 12 months of the reintroduction of the need of the human salesperson that still works with leads, but you need that human to get it across the finish line.
Greg, we had a guest on, I don't know, three months ago named Adam Benzman, who's a sales guy, a sales trainer for the roofing industry. And I call that, just to give you a little anecdote, we titled the episode, Get Your Sales Team's Ass in Gear, or How to Get Your Sales Team's Ass in Gear. And it was that exact concept. It's sort of like everyone has sort of been enjoying these really fancy digital marketing funnels, and they have appointments set up for them, and you just kind of rock up to a well set up estimate and you close at 40%. That's just not the reality anymore. We are seeing a resurgence of the ground game. We are seeing a resurgence of pick up the phone and call someone, get on the dials, which I think is kind of refreshing and really cool. Now, this is okay. I want to bring this back to the four numbers. We got to get into the, like, owner salary, profit. I want to talk about all this stuff. I feel like we could just talk about this. Yeah. Is all really interesting. How should people, before I get into these four pieces, these four components, which you lay out really clearly in the book, how should people think about and understand this framework to begin with?
Well, you know, there's not 1,000 numbers to look at. So the first thing, like I said, is I've got to get to the true value add number, which is gross margin. In the original book, I did use the term gross profit, and I've since changed that to gross margin, because the original term of gross profit does not have a consistent definition across accounting. And so margin was a better way, you know, to kind of give it a proper definition. So I'll make that statement. In the Simple Numbers 2.0 book, it's always referred to as gross margin. And so the idea is that's the first thing that you've got to look at. And matter of fact, we recommend putting a swear jar in your office that every time you use the word sales or revenue, they got to put a dollar in it, because that... I don't care what your revenue is. I care about what your margin is on a per project basis. That's the key that we've got to elevate everybody's understanding to. So then it is the deployment of labor, because we don't have a variable labor environment. You commit to labor and you got to sell and produce to that labor you're committed to on a month in and month out basis. So gone are the days of the excess labor when I can easily add people, easily let people go or cut their hours and they still stay with me. That just doesn't exist in the current market. And so what you end up doing is you've got to first get to that labor, that gross margin number, then know the total LER. I mean, that's your profit guide. That number just works. And amazingly enough, it's not just for the contractor industry that's a two. Pretty much 90% of the businesses we work with across all industries, that's their number too. I mean, $2 of gross margin for every dollar of labor. And you just rarely, the only primary examples that are different than that, you need a 2.5 if you're a fixed location retail store. You need a 2.5 if you're a distributor. Mm. And those are the only two primary models that are higher than the two for the most part. And so once you know that number, you know, cutting back operating expenses, you're just fighting a losing equation. I mean, you can cut back to one ply toilet paper all you want, you're just going to aggravate everybody. That's not going to make you profitable. It's called go produce. And so these contractors that I met with this week, I mean, every one of them, I gave them this as their marching orders. November is in front of us. You know, today in the middle of October, within a fraction, what you're going to spend in labor for the month of November. Take labor for November, multiply it times two. That's your gross margin target for November. Now, there's a little bit of a problem. There's this holiday in there that affects it. It's like, so what? Find a way to overcome it. But that's your gross margin target. So have you sold enough is the first question. If I hadn't sold enough, I can't beat my team up for not hitting a 2-to-1 labor efficiency ratio. If I sold enough, then do we produce enough? And by the end of November, you're monitoring this week to week throughout the month of November. And so if I see that I don't hit it at the end of November, well, do we have processes that are causing us to not be effective to get good work that's sold, we just didn't get it past the cash register, you know? And if I have a customer or a market causes a delay, weather causes a delay, I've got to be adaptable to go reach into my backlog and pull something into the present and replace that work so that a missed time schedule is not just a free day off for my team. Because we've got a goal that we have to hit month in and month out. If my processes are good, and we don't hit it, then I got to go to the third P. Do we have the right people? So it's pricing and sales, but yeah, I like to use P for price because a lot of times also if you didn't price the work effectively, and this was a big discussion with this group. I mean, because when we're looking at gross margin across the group, it ranged, I mean, we had one really weird anomaly. I'll leave him out. But most everybody was between 30% and 45% of gross margin. The real number ought to be close to about 40 if you're a contractor. And there's actually a fundamental reason why 40% is the optimal margin in the contracting environment.
Why is that?
So a client of mine developed this theory that we've used, and I mean, it was just a brilliant perception of the marketplace. And he said there's four things of value that happen in every economic transaction. And these are value components, not cost components. Marketing is worth 20 cents of the dollar of revenue, but sales, getting something to contract and contractual agreement, is worth 10 cents. Managing the oversight of the activity is worth 10 cents, and the product or service itself is worth 60. So think of this as in business, I can attack that marketing, sales, oversight, product or service from either direction. I'm good at my product or service. I just suck at those other three. Then I should get 60 cents of the equation, and I should work with somebody else who does the marketing, does the sales, and keeps me on schedule. But I can be a viable business just doing that focused product or service. If I'm good at they market it and sell it, but they never have to check in with me through the completion of the project, I can push that 60 cents up to 70. But I gotta be good at managing and make sure that they don't have to check in with me. If I'm just marketing and I can turn it over to somebody to then close it, manage it, and sell it, then I get 20 points and everybody else gets 80. And so when I've got a contractor at a 35% gross margin, I'm beating them up for, you're not charging enough for what you have to carry in labor to manage that project if you're not getting 40% margin.
Correct.
You're not defending the value of what your people are delivering on. Because last time I checked, subs don't show up without you managing them.
Correct.
But that equation has just been fundamentally, awesome to get people's head around the why.
Yeah.
Why does it need to be this number?
Can I ask you about owner salary? Because I don't know if they're contrarian views, but they're maybe like would surprise a lot of business owners, your stance on this. So my understanding of your philosophy on this from the book is that basically like paying taxes is in an indirect way is a good thing. You make the case that it's like a very good KPI to track. And so many, many business owners get into business for themselves because of the perceived, whether or not it's real remains to be seen, but for the perceived advantage of sort of reducing their tax burden, creating some tax efficiencies. So can you just tell us why we should not take advantage of this and sort of be a little happy to pay the tax man?
If you didn't write a big check to your tax agency, you either didn't make any money or you cheated. And both of those are bad. So, it's just absolutely BS. And you're being taken advantage of by bad advisors who are telling you, yeah, I can help you pay no taxes. Just don't make any money. I can help you waste your profits and spend on things that add no value. I'm a leverage guy, just not leverage of debt. I'm leverage of cost relative to create profitability. That's the magic of business. And, you know, my clients are happy to write seven-figure checks in taxes because they know what they made. And so the small ball thinking, and I had a couple of these contractors in this session this week that I had to jump on because you're lying to you're not as profitable as you think you are because you got to put a market-based wage in there for what you should be making to look at profit truth of what the business is producing. Because you will defend a salary 10 times more than you'll defend the bottom line of the business. Because that salary is the moment of truth every payroll cycle that I've got to have cash to cover it and pay the payroll taxes that go along with it. And where profit is this little bit of a delayed effect and I don't look at it on a moment-to-moment basis. But if I don't have cash to make payroll, that is a prime indicator that my business sucks.
Right.
And I got to do something about it.
I think the case that you're making, though, right, is that by being a little bit clandestine, being a little bit cheeky, getting a little bit, you know, you're kind of doing a little bit of number fudging there near the bottom, whether that be underpaying yourself or folding in expenses that maybe shouldn't be in there, by sort of turning the knobs to suit your short-term financial needs and also suit your philosophical aversion to paying taxes, what you are inadvertently doing is you are, as you say in the book, you are basically fogging your view of net income.
Right.
And from a strategic, like, leader, making decisions for the future, maybe one day trying to create an exit, like all these things that are really important, that you are completely screwing yourself in the long-term sense. Is that too simplistic to say? Yeah, or is that basically what you're saying?
Absolutely. Because I'll tell you, 100% of the time, every time that we get somebody to pay themselves a true market wage, they will not only make more in salary, they will improve profitability from where they were before they started making.
Why? How does that work?
It's behavioral economics. I mean, because economics has a significant emotional behavioral component to it. So we must get data to speak truth, or else we give ourselves this long list of excuses to let ourselves go and don't hold ourselves perfectly accountable. But when you're looking at the raw, unadulterated truth of data, you've got to face the music. And people don't like to lose, but if they can cloud the answer, that gives them a little bit of an out. But every time we get them to just face it brutally honestly, we see a significant elevation in the business in terms of both being able to pay the salary and hit that profitability number on top of it.
So how do we calculate a fair market-based wage for ourselves, number one? And then what if the business can't afford it in that given moment?
Well, so to come up with that number, just ask yourself, what would you have to pay somebody that has no ownership to do everything that you do? And there's plenty of freely available wage guidelines in the free market. I would say most free services are probably an average of 5 to 10% overstated, but I'm okay with that. I'd rather you err on the upside than the downside, of that equation. So salary.com is a common website. Glassdoor, you can get some good data from Glassdoor that's free. PayScale, I think, has a free site as well as some paid. We provide that data for our clients. We subscribe to the Economic Research Institute's Salary Assessor Program. So we can pull a wage survey for any position from owner down to dog catcher, by location, by size, by SIC code, so that's not a hard number to come up with, in that regard. Now, The bigger question is, like you said, can if the business can't afford it? Well, guess what? That tells you that your business is broken. So that's step one. And so then we say, set your salary at that level. And now if you can't pay it, you're going to, you're going to record it as a salary and then accrue it in the business, because I want you to see that number at the bottom with the brackets around it saying, I lost money this month because I can't pay myself a market wage.
Gotcha.
Because that will spur you to action quicker than, I'm just going to take this wage. And the one I hate is when my peers tell somebody, oh, well, you can pay yourself this salary and we'll save the payroll tax. The payroll tax is just a stupid, nonsensical, doesn't matter number right. at the end of the day. I mean, you're playing small ball right. when you do that.
I love
And it's like,
yeah. Small ball is a good term. You are thinking about, like, I mean, I'm maybe being too bold when I say this, but you're kind of making the case like, hey, that's a loser's mindset. Like, do you want to play right. business? Like, do you want to do this for real? Because this is what real business people do. They're not trying to like get cute at the end of the year to save on, you know, a few thousand bucks in taxes. Let's do this for real.
And here's what I've been telling people is that, oh, my accountant says it's great. I want you to go back to your accountant and say, oh, by the way, now, if you happen to be an S corporation in the U.S., this matters. So go back to your accountant and ask them, now, you tell me that this is an okay salary to pay. Now, if I get audited by the IRS for owner compensation, which is a real thing, and I have to pay the back payroll taxes, you're going to pay the back payroll taxes and the penalties if the IRS disagrees with this salary, and then see what they say then.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. They'll say, oh, no. I mean, you want to talk about somebody that's going to back the truck up quickly. Just ask them that question. That'll prove pretty quickly how truthfully they believe in that number.
That's not really what I meant. Okay. Let's talk about profit. We've dabbled in the gross profit metric in the book. You say very clearly, you go 10%. And I think you're talking about net in this one. You would say 10% profit
That was to revenue. So I've refined it as we've gone forward because I've needed to find a universal number. And what was interesting was, I mean, the first book was a lot of observation. I had data for some things, but I was still questioning some things. And it was kind of interesting when I wrote the first book in 2011. In 21, I went and recorded both books on audio. And I hadn't read the first book in 10 years when I did the audio book for it. And I was kind of thinking, you know, what am I going to find that I don't agree with? And I remember having a moment at the end of the recording going, I kind of pause and go, man, that was a pretty good book. I was still pleased with it. But one of the things that we've really focused on of late is, okay, forget about revenue completely. We've now established our profit standards around profit to gross margin.
Yeah.
And so I can give the audience an updated, so profit to gross margin that we're absolutely 100% staunch on for 99% of the businesses out there is 15% profit to gross margin is your minimum, 20% profit to gross margin is your target, 25% is booking it, and anything above that, you're crushing it, you know, to the market, take advantage of it as long as the market will give it to you. But the market will compete you back. So that really kind of becomes, so everything kind of moved up 5%, but it's been amazing as we tested this across all different industries. Once we do the filter of cost of goods to get to gross margin before any labor, that becomes just an absolute gold standard for businesses, is that 15, 20, 25.
You're saying that 15% of your, a good benchmark is that you should be making, your net profit should be 15% of your gross margin. Minimum. And then ideally 20 and 25 is amazing. So that's a very, but Greg, that's a very different framing than what most people would do is they would anchor it against, they would anchor it against revenue. They would say 10% net on revenue is really, is good. It's a good place to start. 15 is even better. So what's the value in changing? Like you're not anchoring to top line anymore. You're anchoring to gross margin. Just in terms of going back to the behavioral psychology thing, why anchor it to that and not the top line?
Well, because the contractor market is a really good example. So let's say I'm a kitchen remodeler. Well, I can have a $20,000 piece of stone that I'm putting in for my cabinets versus a $1,500 piece of laminate. It takes the same amount of labor to install both. So I'm going, if I create profitability relative to revenue, that means I'm going to overcharge the person that's using the high-end product, and I'm going to undercharge the person that's using the low-end product.
Okay. This is basically solving for the fact, and I like that you point out that contracting businesses are a good example of this. This is solving for the fact that depending on your industry and your niche and your market, there's a huge amount of basically pass-through expense that you are taking credit for when you claim that you run a $25 million business or a fill in your number, when in reality, how many of that $25 million was just expensive countertops or was just expensive shingles or was just expensive materials that you're passing through to the end user? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I'll give you an example from this week's meeting. We had one guy that was on the absolute bottom end of gross margin percentage. He was at 15% gross margin, which I saw that number and I'm going, oh, that's going to suck. And then I looked down to his bottom line and he was at 28% profit to gross margin.
Mm.
And then as he told his story, he's in a city and he's doing all of these high-end finishes projects. But he's very profitable at it. And so the only other key to being a low margin but high profit business is I need to make sure that the cash flow then works to where I'm not being banked for that project. So my customer and or my vendors have to support me in one way or the other to where I don't have any cash invested in turning over the project. I'm just delivering on. Because really, if you think about it from a contractor's perspective, I am being paid for scoping, procuring, delivering, and doing. Mm-hmm. I got to do four things to be a contractor. And I can, if I miss any one of those four labor components, that's where I miss and don't get my requisite margin value for the deployment of my labor.
Shifting gears here, you talk about a black hole between $1 and $5 million in revenue, and you say that it's a particularly black hole between $2 and $3.5 million. Yep. Can you talk about the root causes of this black hole and just sort of expand on the whole concept and then maybe at the end tack on a few practical points on how we get through it more safely?
Absolutely. So for one, especially for the contractor market, I'm going to tell you that $1 to $5 million is not your revenue number. That's your gross margin number.
Okay.
Because once again, revenue is not relevant because you could be passing through a bunch of stuff and still have the black hole concepts. The black hole concepts are this. Up until about $2 million of gross margin, you're a single cell amoeba as an owner of the business. You're the head of the business. You're the head of sales, head of marketing, head of operations. At about that 2 million plus point, and really especially at about 3 million of gross margin, you have to either give up operations ownership or give up marketing and sales ownership. Now, the dangerous part is most people love to give up the sales side of it because they just hate doing that piece. I got news for you. The owner can sell better than anybody, no matter whether you like it or not. So be careful, because we see a disproportionate amount of businesses getting stuck in growth when the owner tries to extract themselves out of sales. Now, once you're at 5 million plus in gross margin, okay, you're probably in a little better part to get professional sales in to drive it. But when you're in this early stage, it is really, really dicey. Not saying you can't do it, but it is a low probability of success. So just how big of a bet do you want to make? Now, once you split that, unfortunately now you've had to invest in management labor before it can be fully benefited from.
Right.
And so we see this as I add staff to get through the black hole. I don't have enough activity yet to bring it to the bottom line. So I many times push my profitability down to the danger zone. So this is why the 15, 20, 25 matters. If I'm at 15% profitability heading into the black hole and I add labor that isn't productive when I first add it, I'm pushing myself now down to 5, 10% profit to gross margin, hoping that it's going to work. That produces zero positive cash flow. And if I take one shot to the gut during that period, I'm in trouble. If I'm at 20% profit to gross margin going into the black hole and I add that labor, it pushes me maybe worse down to 10, but more than likely only pushes me to 15%. Okay, I'm still cash flow positive and I've got a little stability to take a shot and still get through it. That's the reason why. But see, when we see businesses entering the black hole that are not profitable, growth is not the answer. It's called fix the profitability of where you're at now, then let's go through the black hole.
This is really interesting. I have so many questions about this. Okay, so what I'm understanding you say is you need to have a very, very clean and clear and obvious profit center in order to survive this bet that you're making. And you are making a bet. You're saying, I'm putting chips on the
table. You're a professional gambler, whether you realize it or not.
I'm making a bet that I'm going to hire, you know, in the contractor example, I'm going to hire my first project manager, my first production team. I'm going to start adding basically, these are non-labors, and so they're not directly revenue producing roles. Yes, in theory, and this is the bet part, they lead the revenue producing roles well enough that altogether the system kind of climbs up. If I'm lucky, but no matter what, even if I make really great decisions and I have really great systems, that is still going to take a little while to actually like work itself out in the system. And so there's basically I'm trying to think of a good analogy. You know, if you've ever been like cave diving in Mexico, okay, and you have to like, you're in a cenote and you dive in, you have to like swim underwater from one hole to the other. And you know that there's a hole over there where you can breathe again, but there is still that moment where you're like, okay, here we go. Swim, 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 swim. Yep. I see the light, I get up and you're good. What you don't want to do and why you have to have a really, really great profit model is sort of like, if you don't, the analogy would be you have really small lungs and that distance is way longer than you think. And this is why
I love that analogy, because just think about if you hit the water slightly wrong and it stuns you a little bit.
Yeah.
That's the shot to the gut.
Correct.
That takes away your ability to swim to that next out.
So when people are talking about, when people are, Greg, are feeling, and I'm sure you've heard this probably at these peer groups that you've been at or conferences you've spoken at, you've heard some guy some contractor who's trying to grow a business, and they're sort of saying, and this is in earnest too, like they're being very real and self-effacing and honest, but they go, you know, I'm making less money now at $5 million in revenue than I was at one. What am I doing wrong? Like this is what they're talking about, yes?
Right. But see, that's always the first answer to the equation, because they're talking revenue. I use an example right now in my presentation of two water damage businesses that I was speaking at a water damage conference. One company was a $2 million business that only did mitigation, had very little COGS. They did mostly just labor cleanup and then left. The other company was twice as big, roughly $4 million in revenue. But they said, hey, we're here. Let's be a contractor as well, and we'll fix the floors, and we'll fix the cabinets, and we'll fix the sheetrock. But the thing was, they were only $180,000 more in gross margin then the $2 million business. And by the time you add the management labor that it took to manage the contractor section, they were making half the profit with twice as much revenue. It was a flawed model. Now, you either fix the contracting model or get out of it because you're not good enough at it and you don't have enough of it to actually be consistently profitable for the skill of the labor that you need to deploy. So it's not saying it wasn't a bad idea. It was a bad idea. It was a bad idea because they were not performing that segment and they could get back to their core business, which was very consistently profitable. And so these are the things that, you know, as you, and the thing is in the contractor business, you're a contractor, but you also have lines of business, particular types of projects that are better than others. And so when we take a business and start to turn it on its side and look at it three-dimensionally, then you can start to look at, do I have a particular activity that is causing this depression in my margin model and not getting me the labor efficiency return that I need? But it's all there. Yeah. And the only thing that probably is frustrating is when you've got smaller contractors who haven't made the investment in decent management systems to have be able to measure margin by job. You know, if you've got to have that. To me, I would not be a contractor unless I can measure margin by job effectively.
So I like that. Like if we can turn it on its side, look at it 3D, look at it orthogonally, we do. I mean, that's what we do at Breakthrough Academy. And almost every single time we do, there is one or more line of business that we have to cut. We're not adding anything. We're just saying, stop doing the loser jobs and watch your business grow. You've mentioned labor productivity. And I really want to talk about this because you make the case. I mean, they're all incredibly important, but I look at this one and it really like leaps off the page for me. And you say that labor productivity is sort of the key to get through the black hole. So talk about labor productivity, the role it plays, how we track it, how to get more of it.
You know, I would probably keep most people on the simplistic version of just looking at gross margin to total labor. And that is with you as the owner as a market-based wage. As you get more complex, we can separate it with our contractors between what we identify as their direct labor, what is customer facing, typically in a contractor. So we got two ways we look at direct labor for contractors. If you self-perform activities, I do some framing, I do some sheetrock, I do, you know, certain things. Okay, we're going to put those people in direct labor and then everybody else is going to go into management labor. If I don't do self-performance and I just do project management, I'm going to put project managers into direct labor, and then I'm going to put estimators and owners and back office people in management labor. Now, what we're doing there, there's not a perfect number of direct LER or management LER. It is more about watching it move across time. So yes, I mean, total labor efficiency is a health diagnostic. I can fix your business in 1 month by you getting $2 of gross margin for every dollar of labor in the month of November. And if you can repeat that month after month after month, you're going to be profitable as a business. I haven't seen one yet that didn't work. But the nuance of, do I need to add more of my direct labor? Am I overburdened with management labor? That's more of a movement across time to say, as I add people in a category, does their numerator that they're held accountable for, does that number grow to get back to the norm? Because typically what I show in my talks is in the example of the good water damage business, they're at that entrepreneurial mitosis stage of splitting into an operations or sales and marketing. And if you add an ops manager at $100,000, I show an example of how you have to grow top line $600,000 for that company's model to justify adding a $100,000 ops manager to get you out of operation so you can focus on business development and keep all other things ratable in the model. And so those become, you know, growth characteristics of what, you know, when you grow, yes, all the numbers move, but there was one catalyst. There's always, you know, is my catalyst adding a person that gets everybody more in their perfect role? The two main catalysts for growth is either key labor positions or marketing spend. That's one and 1A of growth catalyst in the business. And you've got to understand that other numbers are going to move, but that was what started that process. But you've got to get back to the perfect pattern as fast as possible once you introduce the catalyst.
You talk, and I really like this framing of things about creating like an NFL style salary cap for your team. And it's a very useful heuristic, just like a mental picture that I think people will get to. Yep. A lot of football watchers, a lot of fantasy football managers listening right now. Why is that a useful way to think, like this salary cap idea? How do we implement that into, say, a construction business?
So you've got one of two choices. I either cut or grow. If you're not at a two labor efficiency, let's say we come in and you're at a 1.7, which means you're probably going to be 5 to 10% profit to gross margin. So you're going to be pretty low on that level, maybe even close to break even, you know, and it said, well, you know, I'm going to do two calculations. I'm going to show you, here's what you've got to grow to keep the labor you have, or here's how much labor you have to cut. Let's line everybody up, and who are you going to get rid of? Who can you miss tomorrow and not notice it? And when people think they can grow into their labor, we call that stage one of denial. You know, if you're at a 1.7 LER and not profitable, you've got to do some cutting in almost 100% of the cases. You may still leave a little bit to grow into, you know, but most of the time, the sure thing is the actual cut. Now, I had one of the people in the peer group this week for the contractors that I told them they needed to add labor. So everything was falling to the owner of the business to manage. She was the primary project manager as well as the estimator and all those things. And I said, you're at a minimum profitability. And so, but the problem is you're the bottleneck. Mm. And so you need to add, and I went through and showed her, says, here's, you know, you need to add a $75,000 position to do project management to get this off of your plate so that you can now, you know, push through and, but you need to grow by X amount, because you can't cut there are like 1.2 million of gross margin. So you're at the minimum viable level as it is. And so cutting isn't an option at that level. Mm. I've got to grow or else I got to go find a different job, you know, at that point. But everybody else was more so, you know, I showed them, hey, the sure thing in your market, you know, if you're doing 7 million of gross margin and you're not profitable, I guarantee you got some unproductive labor that you can cut tomorrow, and given the current labor market, those people will be unemployed for about 15 minutes. You know, so you don't have to worry about, oh, I'm worried about their family or, you know, they have employment. You've got to get back to that. What is that core? And that's just the pruning of getting a team. The idea of thinking that person is going to work with you for all of your business life, I mean, that's just an unrealistic idea.
It's not just unrealistic. It's unhealthy. It's not good
for you and them.
That's what I was going to say. For the bit, you kind of get, it's not rot, but it's staleness. People got to move from thing to thing. Businesses need to move from person to person. That's how innovation happens. That's how growth happens. But I'm very curious if you have a tool, a lens, a way that you coach business owners to do the searching, because look, I mean, human beings, none of us are as shrewd as we think we are. We're going to keep the people we like, and we're going to exit the people we maybe disagree with.
I think everybody inherently knows who's on the cut list.
Do they, Greg? Like, do people
they,
just kind of?
They do. They do. And here's the exercise. It's really simple. I attribute this to Cameron Harold, who was the CEO of 1-800.
He's been on the show. We love him.
Yeah. So Cameron will tell you, close your eyes, picture your team standing in front of you. How many of these people would you enthusiastically rehire?
Right.
That's the defining characteristic. Because in many cases, it's less about their technical ability as their energy that they bring to the business. You can have a really productive person that meets zero of your core values as a business. We refer to those people as a terrorist.
Right.
I mean, they're the person that you're afraid to let go. You need to let them go. They are holding your business back. This is one of the other nuanced things that we talked about, is the one thing that is separating the best businesses right now more than ever are the companies that have good culture. And I'm not talking about good culture because you overpay them and coddle them and let them play games while they're working.
There's beanbags in the office and there's kombucha on tap.
That's not culture. That's babysitting. Good culture is people doing good, valuable work that could be messy, smelly, dirty, but it's valuable. And they have each other's back. They work as a team. And we see this in the sports world all the time. You know, I mean, the New York Yankees are just now getting back to the World Series for the first time in 15 years, and they have consistently one of the top three payrolls in the business. Their LER sucks.
Right.
You know, and it's only because of management.
Yeah.
It's a management problem that they have. And yet you have very effective, you know, teams out there that, you know, baseball is a little bit of a pure thing because there's not a salary cap. Every team doesn't pay the same. If you look at the NFL, look at the Cleveland Browns versus the Kansas City Chiefs. The Browns haven't even sniffed a playoff, you know, in what, 30 years or something like that.
Cowboys are the same. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's even worse. so those examples, you know, you can certainly look at. But I'm telling you, culture, I told somebody the other day, I wish I had a handbook to tell somebody how to build a company culture because there's people that talk about it and I get that. But the companies that I see that have it's almost magical as to how it organically developed. And it's a very precious thing that you want to hold on to when you have it. But we're now, and this is why I say we're now into the street fight economy instead of the participation trophy. We're now starting to see the benefit of that culture economically. Mm. I mean, literally a third more in profitability, sometimes double the profitability from those good culture companies in the same industry versus the bad culture ones.
I got a question to close here and kind of bring this in for a landing, Greg. Like this has been such an enlightening conversation. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. Like you have a very big body of work. You have the privilege of being able to, you've got this thing I call aggregate perspective, meaning I've looked at a lot of different businesses. I've looked at the P&Ls. I've met the owners. I've peered into spreadsheets and buildings and the actual reality of many, many companies. Most entrepreneurs only have the vantage point of their own. And so it's not always that I get a chance to ask someone who has this wider vantage point, this aggregate perspective. When working with as many business owners as you have, what habits and mindsets do you notice amongst the most profitable? Not the biggest, the huge revenue, the sort of big dick energy guys and women, like the most profitable operators and entrepreneurs. What are the habits and mindsets you notice about them?
Gosh, I mean, you know, there's a lot of variation to it, but I would say, I mean, one, they are aiming at something. You know, one of my quotes that I'm known for is a man who aims at nothing hits it with amazing accuracy. So I would say the people who are good at setting a very discernible target, not like a BHAG, which I'm not a big BHAG fan. I mean, big, hairy, audacious goal. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's just fool's talk. I mean, I'm a more tangible person of give me, I like Shannon Susko has this concept called a 3-AG, 3-year highly achievable goal. That I can align with because I can define it, I can aim at it, and it's near enough in perspective because the 10-year window planning kind of stuff is a little bit difficult at the moment given the current marketplace. So, so if you're in contracting is what I call one of the necessary businesses. There's a little bit of an element of discretionary, but there's a lot of necessary to it. And so I can really look at things from what is most important. And so first, I'm good at setting targets, but I'm also good at executing it timely. So the business, so I always love to ask this question. How many people have fired someone too soon? anybody raise their hand?
That's a great question. Almost no one.
Really, I never had anybody actually admit to it. Because I think a lot of that is the business owners who really have courage, they will do the hard thing at the earliest possible moment. And I think that really probably speaks volumes of probably the most critical characteristic, because everybody can ride the wave of easy. But, you know, I always like to say, you know, the difference between professional money investors, the PE guys, and an entrepreneur, money chases easy, entrepreneurs overcome hard. And I really love working with the entrepreneurs that overcome hard. That's where my respect for them just elevates of, you know, and you marvel at, man, that took a lot of guts and bravery. I mean, and I'll tell you, I mean, one of the biggest bravery acts that we've seen in the last 3 years has been people pushing to raise their prices when they really didn't know if the customer was going to say yes or not. And I'm telling you, of our good performing clients, a lot of it came because we kept poking them every quarter, every month, of saying that you're giving, you know, we could see it in the trending of the data. You're giving ground in gross margin percentage. Are you defending your price levels? And those that really took courage to step up and continue to tweak their pricing, I mean, that took courage, because you stood the risk of losing a customer to the market.
Greg, this has been incredible. We got to get you to come speak at one of our events or something sometime.
Yeah,
everything that you've just said is very much in line with the stuff that we teach. I just think that you've done it longer and you're better at it. So loved the book. Love everything you're up to. I should have said this earlier, but for those of you listening, if you want, there's a really great article called The Best Team Money Can Buy, written by Greg. We're going to link that in the downloads. I'll also link to Greg's work and his books there as well. Greg, you're the best, man. I really appreciate the time today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, anytime. Look forward to it.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.